not the place, it's not the other people, it's always us. We tend to always blame other people, though, as just an excuse for not finding a way out of the ordinary suffering of life. And of course, you all know the way out is just to let things be. Don't fight the monster, otherwise the monster gets bigger. And for those of you who've had trouble with people snoring in your rooms, because there's always someone who snores, it doesn't matter how thick you make those walls, still you can hear it through the walls. And sometimes if you're not even in the cottage, you can see the cottage vibrate. But it reminds me of this one monk, and his brother was coming to stay at Bodhinyana Monastery, and there was no space. You know, all the guest rooms were full because that's the nature of our monastery in China Grove. Now it's really hard to find spaces to stay. But it was his brother. So he said, look, you know, when we were growing up, we shared a room. It's okay if we share a room now. I said, yeah, of course you can share a room, but be careful. You know, you're old, your brother's old. I'm sure that both of you snore now. He said, that doesn't matter, I'll be able to deal with that. And of course, you know, sharing the same room, it's only a small room in Bodhinyana for the monks' huts. Because monks are mindful, they've got more energy. You know, he was meditating and his brother fell fast asleep. He always fell asleep first. And the trick, if you've got someone who snores, always be the first one to fall asleep. And then you're out of it, you don't hear anything, because they can do whatever they like. So his brother fell asleep first, and then started snoring when this monk was trying to go to sleep. And of course he just couldn't go to sleep. Just the noise was just so loud from his brother. You know, he would do the same later on, it's just his brother started first. So, you know, he started contemplating. You know, what as my teacher kept talking about, Ajahn Brahm, he said, it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you disturb the noise. And be kind to the sound. So instead of just getting angry at the noise, he started to play with the noise, to change the perceptions. You can't stop noises, you can't even stop sort of bodily pains, but certainly you can change your perceptions of these things. So he decided to use his perception and imagine, you know, the snore, as if that is modern symphony of modern music. You know, because it's experimental, it's avant-garde, it hasn't been done before. And once he had that perception, he built on it, and he said, after only 5 minutes, the snoring became really sonorous and very beautiful, because he just perceived it in a different way. And it was just this beautiful snoring, like some symphony, he said. And that's the last thing he remembered. And he woke up in the morning after a nice deep sleep. Now that is emotional intelligence, that's why I was very proud of that monk. And that's exactly what we do. You know, we can't fight those demons, but we can love them. Thank you for coming to visit me, snoring. And you just change the attitude. Instead of it being sort of a loud, terrible noise, it's something very beautiful and sonorous and wonderful. And then after a while, it's just so nice, and just listen to your brother snoring. Ah, that's so wonderful. And of course, when he didn't react with negativity, it just vanished by itself, and he went into sleep. Now that is a great sort of psychology tool to deal with snoring when you want to go to sleep at night. Any other noises outside, turn them into something beautiful, not something irritating. And then they fade away. Or the same if there's some noise when you're meditating. You know, we try our very best, but sometimes there's maybe a truck outside or an aircraft overhead. This is not on a flight path, but every now and again there's private small aircraft fly over. There's wind, you can't do anything about that, except change your perception. Sound of the wind is just gorgeous. You know, the sound of the birds. Ga, 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 ga. Well, other crows like that. It reminds me of a story. You know, in the Northern Territory, you know, that's up in the bush to the north of Australia, you know, they have these long roads with hardly any towns. And of course, lots of big, big lorries or trucks, depending on where you come from, would go across those. Sometimes like three big trailers on these, they call them road trains. And they noticed that, you know, all the birds which were killed by those trucks, those lorries, you know, they were all crows. Other birds, you know, never managed to get hit by them. And it's so weird that some scientists from a university in New South Wales decided to try and do some research. Why is it that only the crows get hit and no other birds? And after 1 year, they found out the reason why. It's because when any bird, like say a crow, when it goes onto the road, you know, to eat roadkill, they always leave one bird up in the tree as a warning. And the bird up in the tree, they can see something coming. They know how to say, car, car, but they don't know how to say, lorry, lorry. I do apologize for the very silly jokes. So you've got a choice. I'm going to tell these jokes anyway. You can change your perception and think they're funny and have good fun. Or you can have the perception, oh, no, not again. And suffer. So perception is something you can always change, which is wonderful. And that's something we do even with our meditation when we get into what I was going to be talking about this morning, on the breath, the breathing meditation. Because what happens is, so far, present moment awareness, again, this present moment, just being here, and just no thinking. And then people ask, well, what do we do next? Because really, there's nothing much to do. You're not thinking, you're not planning, you're not going anywhere, and the mind becomes quite empty. Now, there's one thing you should know about the mind, or the human brain, whichever you want to call it. The human brain only notices things which change, things which move. It's one of the reasons why when Ajahn Chah, in a simile of the still forest pool, when he sat perfectly still, he literally became invisible. As you would, if you were perfectly still, people wouldn't notice you. Because our brain can only register things which move. And that's one of the reasons why in the Zen tradition of meditation, you can try this if you like, you know, just for something to do if you're a bit bored, just turn your cushion around and just face the wall. And just, with your eyes open, just stare at the wall with a quiet mind in the present moment, see what happens. Because that's the Zen method of meditation. In the Zendos, the meditation hall, everyone is not facing inwards but facing the wall. And you're just looking at that wall with your eyes open, supposed to be meditating. So when I did that once as a student, it was the only meditation center close by to where I was living. And I went there for a weekend retreat. I hadn't got a clue what I was supposed to do, what was going on. But you know, you try anything once. And then I'm looking at that wall, had a peaceful mind, just no thoughts going on. And then the wall vanished. It just disappeared. Now remember, this was the 60s and early 70s. That was cool. That was interesting. That was weird. And in the 70s, we're always into weird stuff. Of course, you know, I didn't take any drugs. I didn't need to, because you get the weird stuff from meditation. As much weird stuff as you like. So you're sitting there watching the wall, and there's no wall left there. It vanished. That was awesome. And at the time, you didn't know what was going on. You just enjoyed it. I was never actually scared. You always wanted to, you know, when you're very young, you're like that. You want adventure, you want to sort of push boundaries, you want to try things no one else has tried before. And you had that sense of adventure when you were young. So when I saw the wall disappear, I wasn't scared at all. I thought, wow, this is really interesting. And also, I was a scientist as well. So why did the wall disappear? And of course, then you figured it out. The human brain only registers things which move. And I'm sitting there, no thoughts in the mind, just watching this wall. It didn't move and didn't change. And so after a while, just the brain, this sense of sight, just flicked off. The switch went and it wasn't there anymore. And that's totally normal. We do that all this time, such as the taste of saliva in your mouth. Now you can notice it. In fact, you all can notice it. That's hard to get rid of. What, you know, feeling my saliva. But it's not going to change at all. And so after a minute or two, it's going to disappear. You're not conscious of it anymore. Or even I notice when you close your eyes. When I close my eyes, I am aware of the inside of my eyelids, first of all. That's what I see. But that doesn't change. It doesn't interest the brain. So after a very short time, sight turns off. Now that's an important part of meditation, to understand that when things are still, they disappear. If you're in a room, it doesn't need to be perfectly quiet. It can be in Singapore, you know, next to a busy road. As long as that's constant noise, it doesn't really increase in intensity, doesn't decrease, there's no horn sound, a constant hum. After a while, you can't hear it anymore. Because the brain is so efficient, it will only notice things which move, which change, which alter. Which is why you can meditate in the middle of a city sometimes, as long as the noise is constant. So, what does that really mean for this meditation? And why did I say this? Is that when you're in the present moment, when you're silent, nothing is moving except it's the only thing left. Which is one of the reasons why in this method of meditation, if you follow the instructions and do it properly, present moment awareness and silence, you become aware of your breath naturally. It's the only thing left for the mind to watch, because it's the only thing left to be moving. And that, I call that Rolls-Royce method of meditation. That's the best. Because then it's a natural breath, you're not doing anything, you're not interfering, and it's always very soft and peaceful and delightful if it comes to you rather than you go to it. So one time when I was thinking, why did the Buddha teach breath meditation? What's so special about the breath? And you know, you realize that it's going to happen anyway. It's one of the last things which stops moving. That's why we're aware of it. When everything else disappears, that's the only thing left. And it also emphasizes another very wonderful way of looking at meditation. You don't focus on anything. Even the present moment, you don't focus on the present moment. You just let go of the past and future. You don't focus on silence. You just let go of all the thinking. You don't focus on the breath. You just let go of everything else until that's the only thing left. So it's actually a letting go rather than a concentrating. Letting go of everything else until this is the only thing left. And that means you're not hard, struggling, forcing your attention on anything. Just everything else has vanished. That's the only thing left to watch. Now, that is a much better attitude to meditation. It's a letting go, it's an abandoning, not being interested in the past or future. Just, you know, seeing the lack of value in all this thinking. And when that happens, it just disappears, it goes. It's not important anymore. And this is the only thing which is important, which is silence or the breath. That is the very best. However, sometimes people find that a bit too advanced for them, even though it's the best, and please remember that, because eventually you get the hang of this. Sometimes that they want to look at the breath. They want to sort of hurry it along a bit. Sometimes they get frustrated. They want to get somewhere. So if you want to bring up the breath, do as much preparation as you possibly can. As much present moment awareness. And not just in this meditation hall, throughout the whole day. Now when you're eating, you know, your toast, present moment awareness, just one piece of toast at a time. And you don't bite it again until the last piece has been tasted. Oh, that's nice. And when there's no taste left, you can swallow. You don't eat as much as you normally do here in this retreat, so you better make the most of the little food you have. Enjoy it to the max, because it's going to go and there's nothing in the afternoon. So really enjoy it. Be in the moment when you're eating. And be silent when you're eating. Don't just, don't mean just not talking, that's the first thing, don't talk to anybody. But don't go thinking about stuff. Because sometimes people can be eating and they're thinking about all sorts of rubbish. And they don't know what they're eating. And I thought you Singaporeans enjoyed your food. If you really want to enjoy your food, present moment awareness and silence. And you bring up that spoon of porridge into your mouth. And because you're mindful, it's a taste explosion. That's delicious. But you pause, don't rush it. People actually rush it to get to the next spoon. What are you doing? The next spoon will come to you. Enjoy the spoon in your mouth right now. Get the most out of it. Suck as much taste and deliciousness out of the food you can. That's what actually mindfulness does. It makes you enjoy life more. One thing at a time. Doing things in this moment and silently. The method which another monk pointed this out years ago, and it's such a very good insight. As you see, when many people are eating, you actually see this, it's like, the people forget about what I say. You see people doing this at lunchtime, eating with a spoon, say. One mouthful is in your food being chewed. Another one is already on your spoon, waiting in line. And another one is heaped up, number three. And you're looking about what's going to be next. And it's amazing, just even eating, just how we are three or four mouthfuls ahead of ourselves all the time. And when you notice that, you think, how stupid that is. What do we do that for? You've got all the time in the world to finish your food. And you don't have to go to work afterwards. You know, you've got time, so enjoy the food. One spoon at a time. And you're eating this food, and as the food is in your mouth, your spoon or chopsticks, whatever you use, is empty. Nothing's on there yet. And there's no little heap of food, which is the third. And you're not looking at what's going to come next. All your attention is in the mouthful of food you're eating now. It's a great little piece of exercise, of present moment awareness, just being here. And even like having a cup of tea. You know, just one mouthful at a time. And you put the cup down and just enjoy it. It's very wonderful when you can do that. That's mindfulness practice, which is present moment awareness and silence. But it also gives you a lot more happiness. You start to really enjoy life more. You know, even just like food. Or, you know, when eventually you go to bed at night. You know, especially you've been meditating, sitting up, walking. And you lay down in this beautiful bed, you can stretch out. Isn't that wonderful? First time, you know, when I go to bed, you stretch out. Oh, this is nice. You know, my legs are a bit sore because of meditating. You stretch out. I really enjoy that. And I don't let it disappear too easily. Mindfulness, present moment awareness and silence. I'm not started thinking, what am I going to do next? You know, what am I going to dream about? What's going to happen? No, I'm enjoying. You know, the bed is one of the most comfortable places you can possibly have. So sometimes I lay back in there and enjoy it. And I say, I don't want to go to sleep. I want to enjoy my... And sometimes if I can't go to sleep, for some reason, too much tea or something, if I can't go to sleep, I think, why should I go to sleep? This is the most comfortable place in the whole monastery, in my bed. I don't want to go. This is cozy. Have you ever woken up in the morning and it's so cozy and warm in your bed, you don't want to get up? That's what it's like when you go to bed as well. Why waste that wonderful experience by going to sleep? So I lay down there, and I lay down. I'm like, I don't want to go to sleep. This is just too comfortable. I just want to enjoy it. Just laying back here, stretched out, warm and cozy. I don't want to go to sleep. And of course, the next thing I notice, I wake up in the morning. It's simple psychology. When you want to go to sleep, you can't. Wanting causes stress. When you don't want, you just, oh, it doesn't matter, I don't want to go to sleep. And you go to sleep. Just like many people here, they tell me, all retreats, it's the same. When they're meditating, especially in the afternoon or late at night, they fall asleep. You see them down here. Half asleep. So they think, I'll go to bed now. So they go to bed and they lay down and they can't go to sleep. When they meditate, they fall asleep. When they're in bed, they're awake. So what's the solution? It's an easy solution. When you come in here, bring your pillow. Sleep properly. When you go back at night, meditate. Play around like that. Anyway, back to the breath. So first of all, the breath comes up naturally. But sometimes, you know, we can actually just invite the breath in. Now, I must admit, I was taught by lay people when I first started meditation, and they said, concentrate on the breath. It's not a good idea. Number one, meditation is nothing to do with concentration. That's one of my evil words. When people say concentration in the monastery, I tell them to wash out their mouth. Never say. And I do that because word concentration has caused so much suffering for meditators. The word is samadhi. And sometimes it's, you know, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, right samadhi. And too many people call it right concentration. And that is stress. And it has a very bad associations. If you were supposed to be doing concentration, what would this place be? Concentration camp. And I'd have guards at all the cottages and wake you up in the morning and towers with machine guns to make sure if anyone breaks noble silence, rat-a-tat-a-tat, shoot you for breaking the rules. Because it's not concentration. And concentration, you can know, comes with force. That's when you're at school. Concentrate. Come on, concentrate. That tires you out. So it is not meaning concentration. Samadhi is stillness. And you know, if there's one thing which, you know, I've achieved as a monk, is, you know, I'm still working on, you know, is pushing that point. It's stillness, not concentration. That changes the whole idea of meditation. From not something you do, but something you let happen. Because you can't make the mind be still. You can only let it be still. So it's stillness. So if you have, are you going to watch the breath? It is breaking the stillness. But you can, it doesn't really matter so much at the beginning of meditation. You can just invite the breath in. It's doing something. But when it comes in, you don't hold it hard and tight. Your breath is not your maid. Some of you have maids in Singapore which you order and tell what to do, because that's your right, you know, up to a certain point. But don't treat your breath as a slave, a servant. Treat it as an equal, as a friend. And that changes just the whole way that you watch the breath. It's not something you control. It's not something you can concentrate on. If you have a friend, how can you spend a lot of time with them? By telling them, you stay with me today. I'm going to the shopping mall, you're going to come with me to the shopping mall. I'm going to have lunch, you're going to have lunch with me. After lunch, we're going to go watch a movie, you're going to watch a movie with me. Has any of you ever done that with a friend? Tell them how to spend the day with you? And if you did, the friend would run away. They'd never want to get close to you anymore. Because you're a control freak. But if you have a friend, you say, you know, you're free today? Yeah, free. Where do you want to go today? Oh, let's go shopping. Say, okay, go shopping. And if you don't treat your friend as a slave to be told what to do, but and then, you know, she says, well, where do you want to go? Yeah, let's go for a cup of coffee. And then afterwards, what do you want to do now? Oh, let's go to the temple. When you work together like that, you like hanging out with such a person. They're a good friend. Now that is what happens with your breath. If you try and control your breath, breath, you come in long. Breath, you go out long. What's going to happen? Your breath is going to run away from you. It's not going to stick around. Where's my breath gone? I'll tell you where your breath has gone. It's hiding. It's trying to escape at all costs from you, you control freak monster. So that is not how to watch the breath, by controlling it. You just let it come in, let it go out. And those first two stages of anapanasati, watching the long breath and the short breath, they're not something you have to do one after the other. It's just take your choice, one of those or the other. Or just, when I started meditating on my breath, I thought, well, what happens if your breath is not long and not short? It's, you know, it's in the middle, which is the usual breath. That means I'm not doing anapanasati. I'm not following the instructions of the Buddha. I've got to make it long, I've got to make it short, but it doesn't want to be. It's in the middle somewhere. I must be doing it wrong. And of course you're not doing it wrong. It just means at the very beginning when you're watching your breath, make it interesting. To make it interesting, you just say, well, no, is it long or is it short? Is it in the middle? Is it about two-thirds? Or is it just extremely long? Or is it really, really short? Or it just, you know, gives you something else to watch. But you don't force it, you just watch it as it is, what it happens to be right now. It's just the first two stages is giving you something of interest with the breath. And the same goes with what I was mentioning yesterday with using a mantra with the breath. You know, breathing in peace. Breathe out, let go. That's one of my favorite ones which I teach, and I practice that sometimes, teach to lay people when they start watching the breath. Because when you say breathing in peace, it's not just watching the breath, it's giving it some extra, a bit of packaging to make it interesting. A bit of, you know, spice in your food, you know, salt and pepper or whatever else you put on things. It just makes it a little bit more tasty and interesting for you. And also that, you know, the whole idea of breathing in peace, it's a beautiful thing to have peace and just breathe it in and have more peace. And let go of any sort of pain, anger, sickness, tiredness, whatever it is you have, fear, just the idea of breathing out, let go. It's great. And again, this is very common, you know, with people with things like cancers and, you know, other diseases. You know, they breathe in like health, energy, whatever it is, purity. They breathe all that in. And then they breathe out, you know, the cancer, they breathe out the tumor, little by little, just feel it just going out of your body. The mind is very strong, it's powerful. If you keep doing that and believe in it, it actually works. Because, you know, the mind is a forerunner and what you imagine usually comes true. And you can actually do that. And that's a great thing for people with cancer and other stuff, and they do get sort of good results that way. Just the imagination. Sometimes they're breathing in a big healing light. They call it the white light. I don't know why they call it the white light. Now, for me, I prefer brown. But anyway, it doesn't matter, everyone likes their own colours. So breathing in the white light, which is supposed to be healing and pure, and breathing out this dark energy, whatever it is. Now that, actually, you make up your own mantra, what works for you, and it actually does work, because it makes the breath interesting. You're breathing in, you know, it's breathing in the white light, breathing out sort of all the toxins or whatever. It does actually work. So that actually counts as stage one and stage two of anapanasati. It just makes the breath interesting. But of course it is doing quite a lot. People say, what do you mean it's only doing a small amount? It makes most people very peaceful because it's far, far less mental activity than they usually do. So it's still pretty good. But if you want to go deeper, once the breath is there, you don't need to actually to add all these crutches and supports for it. You just watch the breath without any of these long or short or mantras or whatever, you just know the breath. And again, if it's a friend, if you've got good attitude towards it, of course it stays a long time. When people say, well, why am I watching the breath and it vanishes? It is because you don't like it. You've got a wrong relationship with your breath. You control it. Anything you like stays with you a long time. Just naturally, you don't have to force it. I know some people who can sit perfectly still for an hour and a half with hardly moving at all when they're watching a movie. But you sit down here, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, now I've got to get up. Why is that? Because a movie is interesting. You get into it, you get involved in it, it's fun. Now, I saw that that is how we have to do some meditation. And not by watching movies, but by looking at your breath and getting some fun with it. Now, the delight in the breath, it does happen naturally sooner or later. Simply because, well, I think I said yesterday, last night, an important, fundamental thing to understand about meditation. The more still you are, the less going on in your mind, the more powerful your mindfulness, the happier you are. You start getting mental energy. And the full explanation of this, and I repeat this many times because this is crucial to understanding how meditation works. Two parts of the human mind. One is called doing, thinking, planning, controlling. It's the active part of the mind. And the second part of the mind I call the knower. It can listen, it can feel, but it doesn't react at all. It is mindfulness. It just knows, but doesn't do anything. Now, of those two parts of the mind, I call it knower and doer. You will notice that your doer, your active mind, thinking, planning, managing, solving problems, that takes up a huge proportion of your mental energy. So much mental energy is used up by doing stuff that your knower, your mindfulness, only takes up the leftovers, the remnants. And that is one of the reasons why people do get tired and depressed. You're doing so much, you've got no energy left for just being aware. And that's especially true of depression. They've got no energy. The knowing is just so dull. You know, they see a sunset, and what a depressed person actually sees is the colours are dull. They're not bright like you see. They see like a red jacket or sort of yellow. They can't see that. It's like washed out, like somebody's put that through the washing machine so many times there's hardly any colour left. And they taste food, and there's just no taste there. It's just like it's no spices, no sweet at all. Everything is just so dull. And it's because their knower has got no energy left. They've been doing so much, struggling and fighting in this world, until they've got nothing left. And all one needs to do is just be still. Don't fight the depression. Just be still. Don't do anything, for goodness sake. Because if you do anything, the little energy you have, you're wasting. But if here we are still, we're not doing anything, because there's nothing much you can do in this retreat center. After a little while, because you're doing less and less and less and less, the energy which will usually be wasted on thinking, managing, complaining, remembering your past, planning your future, all that energy is now free. It just starts flowing into the mindfulness, into knowing. Your mindfulness, you wake up. You're alive, you're alert. Things now have colour. The food tastes good. And the sunsets are incredible. You really are awakening up, which is the word for the Buddha. Bujjhati is the verb to awaken up. Buddha is the awakened one. That's what it really means. Your mindfulness, you can see, you can feel. And the great thing is that what you see is always more beautiful than it was before. The colours, fluorescent yellows. I mean, it gets very deep, powerful. And the food, once you really get some meditation, the food is incredible. You've never tasted food like that before in your life. And the sunset, wow, that is just amazing. Your senses become powerful. And everything gets delightful. That's an amazing thing when you come into strong mindfulness. And when people do that, I just really love that, when I see people just blissing out and just a flower, and seeing a brick and just looking at it, wow! Look at that brick, wow! Now, that is crazy, but this is natural. This is what happens when you are still, when you don't concentrate, when you relax, peaceful, and allow your mind to wake up. So don't do things. It's the doing, the controlling, making things happen, worrying, complaining. That just gets all the energy away. So try and just contain that leaking energy. And then it all builds up. And you get so aware, so happy, so alive. It's a lovely thing to be. Yeah, you're not going to sleep much at night. Who cares? You're just too happy. Having a great time. Now, the reason I say that is because when you go to breath meditation, if you do it right, after a while you're so still, you know, you haven't, your energy, you wake up, you can see the breath, and wow, it's beautiful. It's beautiful breath. And you've heard me say this before, the beautiful breath, the delightful breath. What do you mean, delightful breath? You've been breathing all my life. It's not delightful, it's not unpleasant, it's just breath. How can that be delightful? And it does become delightful. That's how it appears, which is why that is a stage of meditation. It is actually the fifth stage of Anapanasati, the delightful breath. But first of all, you know, I did go sort of, I said I was going to do the 16 stages again. The first stage is watching the short breath or the long breath, that's stage one and two. And then seeing the whole breath. In other words, you're aware enough, you don't just see in and out, you see just the beginning of an in-breath. Right to the end of the in-breath. It stops. It pauses. And then it starts going out again. See the whole of the out-breath right to the very end. That's the whole breath. That's stage three. So you're awake enough. It's not breathing in and breathing out. There's thousands of different sensations of just one in-breath. And no in-breath are the same. I don't know how many in-breaths you breathe in one lifetime. You know, probably a few hundred thousand. But there's no two of those 100,000 in-breaths are ever the same. Same as the out-breath. It's incredible when you really get into this. It's the same when you do walking meditation. When you do walking meditation, yeah, you know, you're watching your feet move left, right. After a while, just one step is thousands of individual little movements in your legs and in your feet. You feel, you know, your tendons tense up and your heel starts to lift off the ground. You start to see, you know, maybe you twist a little bit. And you notice every movement as the foot hasn't left the ground yet, it's beginning to lift up. And you can feel the muscles in your leg pull the foot up as it goes up through the air. And I notice that when I walk, it doesn't go vertically up, it goes up and back a bit. And then once it's lifted up, then it goes forward in a little arc. It goes up at the end. And then it goes down onto the ground. And then it settles on the ground. And then my weight goes onto that foot, releasing the other leg to be able to walk. And I've actually rushed all of that because I've only got an hour. Sometimes one step you can explain for a whole hour, all the different sensations which go on in there. It's incredible just what goes on. And now you're mindful enough, because of stillness, not doing very much, relaxing, you're energized enough, you can see all of that. And if you don't do that when you're meditating on the sitting down, you'll see that when you're doing the walking meditation. That will happen to you. It's really common. You start to really get into this walking, and just how you feel all these different sensations. You become like a dancer. A dancer has to just notice the whole way the body moves. They're just so aware of everything which happens. Just like in doing Tai Chi. But you're now doing it in walking meditation. Your mindfulness is increasing. And after a while, just, you know, you see the full movement of the feet, like the full movement of the breath. And the fourth stage of Anapanasati is just you calm that down. It calms down naturally. You just can't go fast. The breath starts to slow down. Because you're not doing very much, it's natural. It's not something you do, it's something which happens. Because you're not doing very much, you don't need so much oxygen. You don't breathe in so much. And the breath is nice and smooth and calm. It's really nice. So, you know, that calming the breath down is a fourth stage of Anapanasati. It happens naturally, but sometimes you like to know where you are, what's going on. That's what happens. And then, of course, I jumped ahead earlier. The breath becomes so lovely, so delightful. When it gets to the fifth stage, you know, watching the breath, and it's just a delightful breath with pity and sukha, fifth and sixth stages together, I always call that the pivot point, the turning point of meditation. So once you get to there, then you're away, off, having great fun. And you know, sometimes people say, what, meditating, you're having fun? I thought meditation was something you do like going to the dentist because you're a Buddhist. And you're sort of saying, I have to do this, I don't really like it, but I suppose I better do it once a year, my penance, so I can go to heaven afterwards. You know, I'm president of the Buddhist Fellowship, Brahm Center, I suppose I better go on a retreat, otherwise I lose my reputation. There's nothing to do with that at all. It's just really very good fun when you get into it. And when you get into it, you know, you're sitting here, and it happens naturally because you're just letting go, the breath becomes very soft and mindfulness increases, and you're watching this breath and it's absolutely delicious, it's delightful. It's the most wonderful thing. And other people who haven't meditated before, I can't understand you, you're crazy. You mean watching the breath was better than watching a movie? You know, better than sex? Yes. You have a great fun. And the test is that when you're having a beautiful meditation like that, you get to the delightful breath, breathing in and breathing out with piti sukha. Then, 11 o'clock, lunchtime. But I'm having such a wonderful time. So you have a choice to make, lunch or the delightful breath. When the delightful breath wins, then you're a good meditator. It's not your choice. You know, it's not say, well, I'm going to show off, I'm going to impress other people. You just can't help it. And I always like it when that happens. It gets to like, I go over and eat at a monastery now. It's great when that happens. You know, maybe in the morning at breakfast when I'm still here, I ring the gong and people are just still sitting here. I don't want breakfast. Having too good a time. Even though you haven't eaten evening meal, nothing since the lunch the following day, 7 o'clock in the morning, the gong goes, you meditate here. Sorry, breakfast. Oh, this is good. Carry on. That always happens. Now, if that hasn't happened to you, you can imagine just how delightful this meditation must be, that you're going to sacrifice your breakfast, even your lunch as well. That's how it works. So this meditation is actually really, really good fun. That's why, I am addicted to it. I admit that. I'm a meditation addict, a jhana junkie. Well, it was a great thing to be addicted to. I really recommend it. You have a great, great life. No bad side effects. Actually, there is a side effect. You know, I've told that joke before. You know, that people sometimes say, can anything bad happen to you if you really get into this meditation, get attached to it? I say, yes. What is it? You know, do you get sick? You know, do you die young or whatever? I say, no. You lose your hair. Once you get into meditation, you tend to lose all your hair and tend to start wearing brown. It's really good fun. So anyway, that is that stage of meditation. Now when that happens to you, and it will, sooner or later, you know, when you least expect it, you're meditating here, and it starts to get really enjoyable. For goodness sake, don't be afraid. Oh, please, now out of a gift to me, just bliss out. Because sometimes that happens to people, they get the breath starts getting beautiful and nice, and they sort of say, go away. No, me? No, I can't do this. I'm only a lay person. No, no, no. I'm married. I don't want to leave my husband. It There was that. Someone asked me the other day about these teachers. You go to some places and they tell you you've got first jhana, second jhana, this stage, that stage. There was this. I've been a monk a long time now. There's always these people come up, the flavors of the month, give you this fast track to enlightenment. Go to this teacher, you get jhana within a few days. Nice marketing, unfortunately it's fraud. And there was this monk some time ago in Sri Lanka, and he was, you know, saying all these people getting jhanas and enlightenment. And, you know, people were getting sucked into that. And there was this one of our members here, I shouldn't say who they are because many of you know them. And the husband was over in Sri Lanka meditating, the wife was back here. You know, they were in maybe their mid-40s. And, you know, he would give her a call every few days. He said, how are you going? I've got third jhana today. Wow, brilliant. Another couple of days. Yeah, the teacher said it was fourth jhana today. Sadhu, 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 amazing. The next few days, he said, yeah, my teacher said it was stream winning today. Wow, that's impressive. A few days later, he said he was a once returner. And that really was the end of it. That was, and the wife said, you come home straight away. Because if you get to the next stage of an anagami, you won't want to go to work anymore, and we won't be able to pay off our mortgage for our house. You come home straight away. She didn't want her husband to become an arahat. You had to pay off the mortgage and work. So you pay off our debts first of all, and then you can go off and become an arahat. It was all fake stuff in the end, but you know, people believed it. Anyway, so when you get to the delightful breath, you know, you can feel that. You can't fake that. You know, you feel it, and you're having a great time, and you are happy. And you know, do you love people? Do you care for people? Now, what is the thing you want out of people more than anything else for you to be happy? And I've known you for a long time. And I care for you guys. I've known you for a long time. And what really makes me happy as a teacher is to see you blissing out. That's how much I care for you. I want you really to be happy. I want to see you sitting here, just stupid smile on your face, missing your lunch and saying, oh, this is such a wonderful meditation. Oh, yeah, this I can do this. Oh, yeah. So that's my aspirations. And it's not that hard to do. You get so beautiful in meditation. That's what happens. And you're with the breath, and it's delightful and wonderful for a long time. When people say, what do I do next? If you have that thought, you haven't got the delightful breath. If it's really the delightful breath, you say, oh, wow, who wants anything else? I'm just so happy here. And what more do you want? You're content, happy, satisfied, even in that stage. So once you are satisfied like that and happy, you get very peaceful. You don't want anything in the whole world just to be with this little old breath just coming in. So simple, so content. And because of that, you're doing even less. Which means you get more still. So still, your breath disappears. It's gone. Now, many times people's breath disappears, but they haven't had enough energy yet. They haven't stayed with the breath long enough, built up enough oomph. And one, again, one of the reasons I should have gone back to this, people are afraid of happiness. It's weird. But, you know, when you can have a little bit of happiness, but too much happiness, you feel guilty. I'm happy, why can't other people be happy? Right? I should be helping out the poor people. I shouldn't just be indulging in happiness. I should be a bodhisattva as well. Stop being happy. Sometimes it's because of guilt, because you don't think you deserve to be happy. You've been a bad girl, a bad boy. You know, is it because of something I've done in the past? That means I can't get jhana now. No way. Even Angulimala, he could get jhana and enlightenment, and he'd kill so many people. That's one of the things when people ask that question, can everybody in this room become enlightened? And I ask them, is there any serial killers here? Is anyone? Well, if you're not in that stage and you're much better than that and a serial killer could get enlightened, sure, you can become enlightened. That's why it's really impressive to see the sort of people who became enlightened in the time of the Buddha. Some weren't like intellectually retarded, like Chudapadaka's brother, couldn't understand any of the teachings. And so his brother, you know, who was an arahat, you know, the younger brother was, you know, quite stupid. He just gave him a piece of cloth, white cloth, and said, keep wiping this every day. And as he wiped it, he realized that just what was once very clean and pure eventually becomes dirty with age. It becomes impure, everything just fades away and just disappears. There can be no happiness in this life because just with use, things always decay, whether that's your body, whether that's your mind, anything. And that taught him how to let go. He let go so much, he became fully enlightened. And so, intellectually disabled, hunchbacks, that was Bada, the dwarf. They were prostitutes, became nuns, became fully enlightened. Crazy people, Patachara. She was a lady who came into the Jeta Grove Monastery totally naked. And that's why I tell people, sometimes, I don't know what it's like in a Buddhist fellowship, but there's always prudes in our Buddhist societies, and sometimes girls come in not properly dressed. They're showing off their boobs and stuff in Perth. And when they come in, people say, oh, get out, get out, get out, you know, you'll infect the monks. It's crazy. Come on, you've been a monk long enough to not get involved in that. So what happened, this totally naked girl, she was young, you know, just married, just lost her lost her second child at the same time. And just, you know, just really young, beautiful. She came in totally naked. And some of the prudes said, get out of here, the Buddha's in here. The Buddha said, stop it, bring her in. And because she was mad and crazy through the grief of losing her parents, her husband and her two children all on the same day. Totally out of her head. Naked, come in, taught the Dhamma. And she became, now I do have heroes, she's one of my heroes. Because where she came from, how she became enlightened, and she was one of the greatest of teachers. That's why if you read the Terigata, the verses of the enlightened nuns, and they always kept on saying that I was meditating for years, getting absolutely nowhere. You know, does that ring a bell for you? Meditating for years, getting absolutely nowhere. And then this teacher came along. And within a few days, I was totally enlightened. And all these arahats in the time the Buddha said that, and who they were referring to is Patachara. She was one hell of a teacher. She could come along, people meditating for years, getting nowhere, and she could just point out the mistake, tell them what to do, and they were off within days. After meditating for years with great teachers like the Buddha, she could actually see, do, and they were fully enlightened. She was amazing. So anyway, you know that everyone can become enlightened. Even you. But sometimes we get close and, oh, no, I don't want to. You're a bit afraid. And one thing with that meditation, when you get to the delightful breath, you're afraid of the sheer power of it. Because this is really, really powerful. You're getting out of control. Please, get out of control. Get the controller out of the way. Just let go. Go for the ride. And as I often tell you, you are perfectly safe. You've got a really good teacher in front of you. I know what I'm talking about. I know what your experience is. I've been there myself. Yeah, it's scary sometimes, but it's incredibly good fun. And you get huge benefits afterwards. If you want to understand the Buddha's teachings, this is how you do it. If you want to get stream winning, this is how it happens. Bliss, power, amazing, but you have to just disappear. You can't control this. Now, many things in your life, you know, you remain, have some a bit of control. Your kids, you still control them a little bit. Your body, you control it a little bit. Even at night time, when you're asleep, you're still retaining a little bit of control over your body. But here, totally letting it go. Everything. That's bliss. Freedom. So when you do get delightful breath, please remember, don't be afraid. You are perfectly safe. And even health-wise, it's brilliant. You know, I don't know how this happens. I never physiologically, scientifically know why this happens, but it does happen. I remember Ajahn Chah telling me he, like many other forest monks, had malaria again and again and again and again. That was just par for the course in those days. He lived in the jungles. And there was no medicine. You just had to bear with the malaria. And he said one day he had a fever, and basically he got fed up with having the fevers. You know, sometimes, again, your back's against a wall. So now let's do what the Buddha would do. Let's meditate. So he meditated right into that fever. And just like I've been telling you, you always go into things. Never go onto things. Never try to get rid of things. You take that monster, that fever, and you go right inside of it. You have a pain, an unendurable pain sometimes. Don't run away from it. Don't try and get rid of it. Just go into it. That takes courage. But you go right into it. And that's what Ajahn Chah described. He went right into the middle of the fever. That's how he described it. And in the middle, it was cool. But he could feel the fire around him. He said it was like being in the middle of this big conflagration. As it got hotter and hotter, in the middle he was cool and safe, but on the outside it was hotter and hotter and incredibly hot, intensely hot, and then it exploded. And that was the last time he had malaria. It went, disappeared. And I remember him telling me that story. But, you know, I never realized, you know, some of the things which happened to me in my early life. One of the diseases I got was grub typhus. I mentioned that many times before about just a nurse who would come and inject me in the bum twice a day with these dull needles. And I'm not exaggerating. They were incredibly dull, blunt needles. You know, not like, you know, you have injections these days. These days, the needles are just so fine. You know, you hardly feel them. But these ones, you know, had to sharpen them up on the stone before. No, they didn't do that. But, you know, I imagine they did. They were really, really blunt. Because this nurse, no joke, she was not some petite nurse I have in sort of... No, she would never get a job on Singapore Airlines. This nurse was so big, old and tough. And she took the... This is absolutely true. On my back, on my front, you know, took the sort of the sabong up and bang, stab you. And with all of my loving kindness training, not her. I hated her. And my bottom was really sore after a few days of that. Wow. That was only one of the things on these days, but I had fever for about 3 or 4 weeks. And I remember too, you know, it's just maybe my good karma, deciding, since I've had enough of this, and just on the bed, just deciding, I'm going to meditate now. And just go right inside of it. Just, I never realized at the time, it took years later before I joined the dots, and actually that was what Ajahn Chah did. Right inside. I didn't actually feel any fire, I was just blissing out. And now when you feel that bad, sick, with a fever, aching bones, absolutely zero energy, never felt so tired ever since, so exhausted, so lack of any energy, not even to stand up. And going right inside, blissing out. It was so wonderful, just the contrast between the ache, the pain, the lack of energy, no happiness, no joy, and going into meditation, just, wow, this is wonderful. Such a relief. But what I never realized was that was almost certainly the time when the fever broke. They're trying all sorts of antibiotics. They never realized it was grub typhus. They didn't know what it was. And then it broke. And then, fine, gone. A few days later, out of hospital. But what was important, it was just so blissful. You could do that even with a fever. So all you do is just go inside of things. You let go. No, but you know, at least I'm not afraid of those weird stuff. Some of you think, what's going on here? Is this right? I've never done this before. You know, can I handle this? You can. That's one of the other nice... I love saying these things because it happened to someone recently. And I was just smiling and laughing when they were telling me. So yeah, I remember that time I did this. But they were meditating and just so getting nimittas coming up. But very powerful lights in their mind. And they said, it was just so happy. They thought they were going to explode. They thought that no human being could take so much happiness. And I remember when that occurred to me, just really blissing out, really big time. And just, no, you can't take any more of this.
but I found out you can. And that's what this person was saying, that they got this and that, and they said, Jesus, this is the limit, I can't do any more. But, you know, they had enough courage to go a bit further, and they find you can take more bliss. It doesn't harm you. It doesn't hurt you. You just get really healthy. And also, you just have a wonderful time and great insights, which I'll talk about later on in this retreat. How does that happen? Not by wanting. You think, yes, okay, that's what I want. Come on. Here we go. And then you come and complain to me. Ajahn Brahm, you promised me bliss better than sex, and I haven't got it yet. I've been coming here for years because of that. Where is it? You fraud, Ajahn Brahm. Because you haven't been following the instructions. Remember, follow the instructions, for goodness sake. Remember them. Just let go. Present moment awareness. Silence. The breath comes to you. If you want to see the breath, just invite it in. You know, to get it interested in it first of all. You know, if it's not that nice to begin with, breathing in peace, breathe out, let go. Or breathing whatever else you want and breathe out whatever else you want. Just make it interesting. It becomes really soft and peaceful and beautiful. And when it gets beautiful, again, that's where you just let go. Totally, you take off and all these other things happen. I've already gone so far into breath meditation. What did I get to? The delightful breath. And that's fifth and sixth stages of Anapanasati. There's another 10 stages to go. Wow. We've only just started. But that will come tomorrow. Same time, same place. Thank you for listening. Sadhu. 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 There we go.